This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look at the top stories in the coming week from our Daybreak anchors all around the world. Straight ahead on the program, a preview of the employment picture, plus earnings from Pepsi and Costco. I'm Bob Moon in New York.
I'm Amy Morris in Washington. The new Supreme Court term is just around the corner. What cases should you be watching for?
And I'm Roger Hearing in London, where we're looking at the latest stages of the Brexit crisis.
I'm Jessica Summers in New York, where we're taking a look at the future of renewable energy and how solar and wind are taking over power grids.
And in Asia, a piercing look at the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. I'm Brian Curtis here in Hong Kong with that story coming up.
That's all straight ahead on Bloomberg Daybreak on Bloomberg 1130 New York, Bloomberg 99.1 Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 1061 Boston, Bloomberg 960 San Francisco, Sirius XM 119, and around the world on BloombergRadio.com and via the Bloomberg Business app.
Good day to you. I'm Bob Moon. We begin today's program with the U.S. economy. Investors will look to Friday's jobs report to gauge how the U.S. economy is holding up, as well as any clues to the Fed's next move. And for more, let's turn to Bloomberg Economics Senior U.S. Economist, Yelena Shelecheva. Yelena, the jobs report, how does that inform the Fed going forward?
The jobs report is just one indicator that is, telling the Fed what is going on in a broader economy. So it's an important one, of course. And right now, what we are seeing is some slowdown in hiring momentum. So the report for the month of August was already showing a significant slowdown in momentum. And not only in the industries that are directly affected by trade tensions and recent uncertainty surrounding all this conflict, but also you see a significant slowdown in other sectors, particularly in the services sectors of the economy, which is telling us that all this uncertainty is spreading into a broader economy and is affecting broader economic outlook.
I was going to suggest that if the jobs market continues to show softness in this next report, that it might be Katie bar the door. But when it comes to good news versus bad news, the market always interprets that a totally different way, right?
Sure. So, but I don't think we're going to get any exciting numbers this time. Mm-hmm. I think we will probably see more of the same, some softer numbers, but still not a critical slowdown in terms of jobs. So we'll... Our own forecast is for 135,000 with a modest decline in the unemployment rate. I think that's what we should expect given what is going on in the economy and what the recent surveys are telling us and really what, what the slowdown in overall economic growth is suggesting.
Does that tell you anything about the odds for further rate cuts?
I think it would be consistent if our forecast proves correct. You know, that would probably be consistent with further rate cuts. In our view, the Fed will cut rates in October and December of this year. But having said that, I think the economy is okay. We do see a slowdown in momentum, but that is not what is really pushing the Fed's hand. It's the financial markets. It's really the inversion of the yield curve that is making the Fed cut rates at this time. So the Fed, yes, they say, okay, we don't know. This time might be different. QE policies might have suppressed the longer part of the yield curve, but still they don't want to have the yield curve inverted. It's not something that the central bank wants to see. So they can provide some insurance cuts at this point, and that is what they're going to do in our view.
How much has this become a philosophical question for members of the Fed, the idea that they are responding to the markets? I mean, there was a time when they wouldn't even wanted to have come close to admitting that.
Okay, from economy to philosophy. I think, well, it's always a question. It's always like chicken and egg kind of game here. So obviously the Fed doesn't want to look like they are all responding to what the markets want. And they want to be in charge. But at the same time, they do incorporate financial variables into their projections for economic outlook. And at this point, it doesn't look pretty. So they have to incorporate financial variables that are telling them, okay, maybe policy is a little bit too tight at this point. So you really need to provide some accommodation.
Yeah, and that attunes us to Fed speak. We've got some appearances coming up. What are you going to be listening for?
So we have this Fed Listens event coming up, and it will be interesting to hear from policymakers. But I think until we get closer to the next policy meeting, which is in October, we're really not going to be able to say what exactly each participant wants to do at this meeting. They will be watching a lot of data, and in the meantime, they will be talking about some long-term perspectives. So the Fed Listens event, for example, on Friday will feature a couple of board members, and Jay Powell will provide opening remarks. So the Fed has been looking into their policy framework, and they really want to understand whether the old framework still applies in current circumstances. So they have been organizing all these events and conferences and panels, and they're just collecting some feedback from different constituents about how the Fed policy affects the lives of real Americans.
And our thanks to Bloomberg Economics senior U.S. economist Yelena Shalechiva. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, the Brexit clock continues to tick down. We'll have the latest next. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Let's head to London now, where the Brexit crisis is reaching a new stage as the clock ticks down towards the October 31st deadline set by the Prime Minister to leave the EU, deal or no deal. For more on the latest developments, let's head to London and bring in Bloomberg Daybreak Europe anchor Roger Hearing.
Bob, it's a strange week, beginning with the Conservative Party conference opening in Manchester without the customary parliamentary break to allow MPs to get there. Boris Johnson's leading a government that can't pass laws because he's got no majority and he's unable to force the general election that he wants. And he's forced by law to ask the EU for a new extension on the date the UK leaves if he doesn't get a new deal by October the 19th. Time is short and choices are few. Well, for more on all this, I've been joined by Bloomberg's UK government reporter, Rob Hutton, and Brexit editor, Ed Evans. Well, Ed, let me come to you first. What do you think is actually likely to happen this week?
We're going to see the Conservatives meet for their party conference. We're going to put it back at Westminster. We're going to be watching what happens with the rebel MPs. What do they do next? Do they try and tighten up the Benn Act? That is, of course, the legislation that stops Boris Johnson from pursuing a no-deal Brexit. Do they try and force a vote of no confidence on the government? And, of course, the other part of this is the talks are going to be continuing in Brussels.
Yeah, well, let me bring in Rob then. OK, so what do you see coming and what do you see as being Boris's main hurdles at the moment?
So the return of Parliament, one of the odd things about bringing back Parliament was that the entire point of proroguing Parliament was to stop Parliament from passing the Benn Act. And then that spectacularly backfired when the effect that it actually had was to make MPs think, oh, my goodness, we have to stop him. We have to stop him now. And they passed the Benn Act, which actually lots of them think they might not have done had he not tried to suspend Parliament. And now it's come back. And people are saying, well, what is it that they wanted to do? And the answer to that slightly is, well, they've sort of done the thing that they wanted to do. But what they're going to do instead, as Ed says, there's a debate about whether or not they need to tighten the Benn Act up. A lot of them think they don't, but maybe they'll do that anyway. Mainly, it's going to be scrutiny. I would not be surprised if there were shenanigans and wizard wheezes, especially while the Tories are having their conference. But actually, the thing is that they don't particularly need Tories to be away to pass things. They can pass things anytime they want, because one of the really, really odd things, and I think we haven't fully grasped this yet, is that although the government remains Boris Johnson, he's in number 10, and he's got the cabinet, and they meet there every week. Actually, the people who decide what happens in Parliament are this group that also meets about once a week, which is the leaders of the opposition parties and various sort of associated groupings, and they sit around and discuss what they're going to do next. And they've got the votes.
The Rebel Alliance, as you might call them.
Yes, yes, and it goes pretty wide. And they are disunited about all sorts of things, but the one thing that absolutely does unite them is they don't want a no-deal Brexit. And the other thing, to be honest, that unites them increasingly is they really don't like Boris Johnson.
OK, well, let me pursue this with you, Ed, which is what chance is there that Boris Johnson can fulfil what he's supposed to do under the Benn Act at the first place, I suppose, which is to get a deal by October the 19th, the EU having its summit 17th and 19th. He's got to do it by the end of that. Is there any chance?
He has to do it by then because the EU has said there is going to be no negotiation with the EU heads of state at that summit. So if there is going to be a deal, it's going to be on Boris Johnson to get there. I think it's a mug's game to try and predict it either way at this point.
All right, fair enough. Thank you very much to Ed Evans there and also to Rob Hutton. I'm Roger Hearing in London. You can catch us every weekday morning here for Bloomberg Daybreak Europe, beginning at 6 a.m. in London and 1 a.m. on Wall Street. Bob.
Thanks, Roger. Let's head to the commodity space for the week ahead now. For that, we bring in Bloomberg's Jessica Summers. Good day to you, Jessica.
Bob, solar and wind will power half the globe by 2050. Now, that is according to Bloomberg NEF forecasts. And they're now the most profitable part of the power business in most of the world. Bloomberg's America's Power and Renewables team leader, Lynn Dwan, joins me from San Francisco to discuss the growth in renewable energy and its impact on slowing climate change. Great to have you, Lynn.
Thanks for having me, Jessica.
Now, in April, for the first time ever, renewable energy supplied more power to America's grid than coal. And in two-thirds of the world, solar and wind have really become the cheapest forms of power. What is this signaling, and what does the next 20 years look like for renewables?
Good question, Jessica. And what it signals is that renewable energy is officially all grown up. This was a business that for years was heavily subsidized and propped up by government mandates, and now solar and wind farms are getting built without subsidies, without government incentives, and they're proliferating not because of moral do-gooders who are trying to save the world, but because the cost of solar panels and wind turbines and batteries have plunged, and they're now the most profitable part of the business of power in the world.
Very interesting. And even though we are seeing solar and wind power accelerate in nations like the U.S., for example, in developing parts of the world, coal still seems to dominate. So what does it look like moving forward for developing nations like China and Indonesia? And will we see more of a switch over to renewables in the next 10 to 20 years?
That is a totally valid point, and you're right, because coal is still king in a lot of parts of the world. In fact, while China is home to the largest capacity of hydro, wind, and solar power, it also remains the world's biggest consumer of coal. And you mentioned Indonesia. Coal plants are so cheap to run that the country is actually projected to nearly double their coal generation in the next 25 years. And that's a bullish case for coal that miners like Peabody point out as a growth story. But what they aren't pointing out is that even China is seen by analysts as gradually shifting away from coal as a means of cleaning up its air and moving more and more toward cleaner forms of energy.
And speaking of that, we just had the UN Climate Action Summit here in New York, so I wanted to continue the conversation around climate change a little bit with you. In the effort to slow climate change, we tend to focus a lot on the energy sector. How helpful is renewable energy, and will we need to see changes in other sectors aside from energy to really make a difference?
Renewable energy is helpful, but to a point. So some context here, electricity generation has traditionally been the largest source of global warming emissions in the world. Today, in the U.S. at least, for the first time since the 1970s, this is no longer the case. American power plants have given off less carbon dioxide emissions than the nation's entire transportation sector, and that's because oil continues to dominate the streets. Now, a lot of that has to do with the fact that we have cheap and cleaner burning natural gas power plants coming online. But wind and solar are playing an increasingly important role and will continue to.
That makes a lot of sense, and it will be very interesting to watch the developments over the next 10 years or so. Lynn, thanks very much for joining me. This is one of the topics we're watching in commodities for the week ahead. In New York, I'm Jessica Summers. Bob?
Thank you, Jessica. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, the 70th anniversary of the People's Republic of China begins against a backdrop of the trade war and turmoil in Hong Kong. We'll have more next. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting live to New York, Bloomberg 1130. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 99.1. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Radio Plus app and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Daybreak.
I'm Bob Moon in New York with your global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. Up later in our program, we head to our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington to see what items are set to top the political agenda in the coming week. But first, Beijing prepares to mark the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China against a backdrop of the trade war with the U.S. and turmoil in Hong Kong. Let's get a preview now with Bloomberg Daybreak Asia anchors Brian Curtis and Doug Christner.
Bob, the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China is on October 1st. It's set to be an enormous and lavish spectacle. Doug and I thought we'd take a close look at what's coming, a military parade and a speech by President Xi Jinping, and juxtapose that with some of the main issues that are looming. The U.S.-China trade war, protests in Hong Kong, soaring pork prices, and the slowest economic growth in decades. So, Ian, we could argue, I suppose, that President Xi Jinping is the most powerful leader since Deng Xiaoping or maybe even Mao Zedong. So this is a really, really big thing this coming week. The Chinese dream will be on display. The issues, at least in China, not so much.
Yeah, Xi Jinping is battling a host of issues here. There's the slowing Chinese economy. There's all the issues with pork. There's the Hong Kong protests, and there's this the ongoing trade war with the U.S. and Donald Trump. So there are a lot of potential things here that could derail the celebrations, or at least remove the focus from what they want, which is to reinforce the supremacy of the Chinese Communist Party, showing off all of this military hardware in a grand parade, and sort of stressing these forward-looking priorities from Xi, the Chinese dream, and trying to make China a more prosperous and more stable society. You also have a lot of rising criticism in the U.S., and we saw that at the U.N. This week of China's human rights record in Xinjiang as well, where there's been lots of criticism of surveillance, of a crackdown on the Uyghur minority there, and all these labor camps and detention camps that people have been focusing on as well.
So the stakes are high, obviously, for the Chinese government, and the optics become very important. From where you sit in Hong Kong, is there concern that protesters may create some kind of disturbance to kind of steal focus, as it were?
Absolutely. I think in Hong Kong, the whole city is sort of bracing for what's likely to be, a 3-5 day period of intense unrest. Protests in the last few weeks have gotten increasingly violent. We've seen barricades in the streets set on fire. There's all sorts of arson going on and vandalism in some of the subway stations here, and huge marches that have kind of transformed over time into these running street battles with police. The protesters themselves are largely angry about China's growing influence in the former colony, and China celebrating National Day, and in Hong Kong, that is actually, the government does try and celebrate that with fireworks and the rest of it. This is a perfect opportunity for the protesters to get their point out, to try and embarrass Xi Jinping by sort of lighting the city up and having all sorts of huge protests here. There's a raft of different events and protests, gatherings, rallies planned over the weekend and rolling into October 1st. So I think you're very likely going to see a lot of disturbances in the city. The Hong Kong government will try and prevent those from happening. They'll be deploying riot police and the rest of it. But it is probably still going to be probably the most significant headache for Xi Jinping as he tries to keep the focus on 70 years of communist rule.
Well, it comes at the time of the U.S.-China trade war, too, and we know that the mainland economy has been slowing quite dramatically on a relative basis. What's the knock-on effect been in Hong Kong?
In Hong Kong, you've seen a gradual sort of slowdown. There was a lot of conferences or events like golf or, you know, just entertainment events have been canceled over the past couple of months. You've seen retail stores, hotels start to sort of put people on temporary leave because there's not many customers. I think a huge impact here has been the steep drop off in people coming into the city from the mainland, which is obviously a huge source of funds. But obviously the protests at the airport, which is a central aviation hub in Asia, have also hit a lot of confidence. You know, people anecdotally, have friends who don't know when they should be leaving for the airport because they're not sure whether the train will be running or whether there's going to be disruptions. And that is not something that you associate with Hong Kong. It's something you associate with you know, more developing parts of Asia, really. And so there's been a steep drop off in flight traffic and visitor arrivals and the rest of it.
Ian, thank you. That's Bloomberg's Asia government reporter, Ian Marlow. I'm Brian Curtis here in Hong Kong, along with Doug Krisner in New York. You can catch us every weekday here for Bloomberg Daybreak Asia, beginning at 6 a.m. in Hong Kong and 6 p.m. on Wall Street. Bob?
Thanks, Brian and Doug. Coming up on Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, we look ahead to earnings from Pepsi, Costco, and Lennar. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg. This is Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend, our global look ahead at the top stories for investors in the coming week. I'm Bob Moon in New York. Coming up, we get the earnings forecast for Costco, Lennar, and Pepsi. But first, let's head to our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington to see what items in politics and government are set to top the agenda in the coming week. And for that, we bring in Amy Morris, host of our Politics, Policy, Power, and Law program, heard weekdays at noon on Bloomberg Radio. Amy.
Thank you, Bob. Coming up in Washington, we're watching out for a list of new Supreme Court cases before the new term begins on October 7th. And joining us now to tell us what to watch for, Bloomberg News Supreme Court reporter Greg Storr. Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here, Amy.
All right. What are some of the biggies that are coming up?
The biggest thing we are watching for is abortion. The court has two abortion cases, one of which will sound a little bit familiar, that they could agree to take up this week, or they could kick over for future weeks. The one you may have heard about has to do with hospital admitting privileges in Louisiana. The Supreme Court last term stopped a Louisiana law requiring admitting privileges from taking effect. The case is very similar to a case a few years ago the Supreme Court decided when it struck down a law in Texas that did much the same thing, and it's going to be a real test of how the Roberts Court looks at abortion, how quickly they want to move.
So are these opportunities for them to say we will take the case or we won't take the case, or is this an opportunity for them to hear the case? What is coming up?
It's an opportunity for them to say we will take the case, and probably we'll get a list either Thursday or Friday of half dozen, 10 new cases that they are going to hear. And these are cases that will probably be scheduled for argument in January or February of next year and decided in the heat of the presidential campaign.
So let's talk a bit about how that process works then. Once they release that list, those are going to be the cases they will be hearing.
That's right. We already have a long list of them that we know they're going to hear in October. They include issues of job discrimination involving people who are gay or transgender, mm-hmm. Big case over the president's effort to rescind the DACA program, and then there's a gun case as well. All we're getting now are some additional cases to add on to that list and hear next year.
Anything that is earth-shattering, groundbreaking, something that could actually change the landscape of how things are done in the U.S.?
Not immediately. Now, not too far down the road, we may get the Supreme Court saying whether it's going to, say, decide the future of the Affordable Care Act. That case is still at the lower court level. We could get an appeal up to the Supreme Court fairly soon. Unlikely they would hear that this term, but we could hear this term whether they're going to take it up for the following term.
Do they ever give you any indication of what maybe they're likely to hear or where, how maybe they're likely to proceed?
You have to read a lot of the tea leaves. So if you go back to that Louisiana abortion case mm-hmm. that I talked about, they stopped that law from going into effect, and five justices, the Chief Justice, John Roberts, and the four liberal justices kept that law from taking effect. When the court does that, it's usually a signal because they consider the merits of the issue a little bit when they make that decision, it's usually a signal that the court is likely to agree to hear that case. That's one reason we're watching that case so closely.
I see. You have to connect the dots to figure out which way they're headed.
Exactly.
So what else are you looking for?
There's another case that the court could act on this week involving Domino's. The question is whether under the Americans with Disabilities Act, a retail store has to make its website accessible to people who are blind or who are deaf. The lawsuit challenges Domino's.
The pizza place.
Yeah. Challenges, says that its mobile phone app and its website don't work with the software that a blind person uses to translate web pages into something that he can hear. It's not clear whether the Americans with Disabilities Act covers that sort of an issue. It's certainly not something that Congress thought about when it passed the law back in 1990. Lower courts are just now starting to grapple with that issue. Not clear the Supreme Court will agree to hear it, but it certainly could.
And we are waiting for these decisions to hear probably October 3rd?
It'll be either Thursday or Friday, so that's the 3rd or the 4th. We don't know yet. Typically, they do it on the Thursday, but for scheduling reasons that I won't bore you with, it's possible it will happen on Friday this year.
Okay, Greg, thanks so much for joining us.
Sure thing.
That is what's happening in the nation's capital. I'm Amy Morris. Catch me every weekday on Bloomberg Politics, Policy, Power, and Law. It airs at noon, Wall Street time, on Bloomberg Radio. Bob.
Amy Morris reporting from our Bloomberg 99.1 newsroom in Washington. Thank you, Amy. Let's turn to the earnings picture now as Costco, Pepsi, and Lennar report profits. And we get the roundup from Bloomberg Stocks columnist Dave Wilson and Bloomberg Stocks reporter Sarah Poncik. Sarah, let me start with you and Costco.
So when you think of Costco, think about similar companies that have already reported earnings that we heard from, the likes of Walmart, the likes of Target. They really blew it out of the water. So you might believe that if you continue to see the consumer shopping at stores like this, maybe that would bode well for Costco. And we do already have a bit of a preview. It was just earlier this month. Costco did release their total comparable sales for August, and that did beat the average analyst estimate. So comp sales for August came in around 5.5% growth, whereas forecasts were calling for closer to 4.5% growth. And we've seen Costco really moving up. We did see Costco moving up after those reports. Costco's been doing unbelievably. It's up about 40% this year. To see anything change, you'd have to see a surprise, since you already have numbers for August and you have an understanding that things have still been going decently well.
Dave, it seems that this is good news for consumer spending.
You can draw that conclusion. Of course, you have to bear in mind that Costco arguably has a very different customer than, say, Walmart and Target that Sarah mentioned, because, you know, they tend to be higher income, spending more money. So, you know, it tells you about a segment of consumers. It doesn't necessarily give you the whole picture. I mean, that said, you know, this is a company that's managed to sustain growth. I mean, you're looking at a bit of a dip in terms of revenue for, their latest quarter, but still relatively strong. And on the earnings front, I mean, slowest growth in 2.5 years, but still up 8%. That's what the analysts are telling us based on their average estimate. So, you know, you put it all together and, you know, this is a company that stands out as a relatively strong retailer. Now, what that tells you about retailing more generally, you kind of have to pull in the, a broader sort of cross section of the industry to really kind of get that reading.
So it seems to me PepsiCo has been something of a moving target.
It has, and we continue to see PepsiCo and other similar companies dealing with very similar issues. For one, we've been dealing with higher commodity costs, commodity inflation. You think of what goes into making a can of Pepsi. Well, that is aluminum, and we've seen aluminum prices rising after those tariffs did go into place. And this has really been a point of contention over past earnings releases in past earnings calls. So you have Bloomberg Intelligence saying that they are actually expecting a mid-single-digit drop in earnings per share due in part to these higher commodity costs. But PepsiCo has also been spending a lot on marketing, so it's possible that we could see margins narrowing as well. But where we have seen a lot of strength in the past through this year really has been the Frito-Lay segment of PepsiCo. So not really the drinks, but more so the snack business. So there will be a lot of interest in seeing whether or not the snack business, Frito-Lay, is still kind of providing assistance to the company and being a bulwark within what many people view as more of a beverage company.
David, we get into the health of home sales.
Yeah, we do, and we actually got a read on that in the past week out of KB Home, which had fiscal third quarter results out. They had a 24% increase in orders in their latest quarter.
Wow.
Their earnings beat projections, and yet the stock really actually kind of tailed off a bit after the results came out. So, you know, it's not like people saw numbers like those and really that they were sort of outside what was anticipated. So, you know, when you talk about Lennar, I mean, which to some extent is a similar builder to KB Home. I mean, you have to kind of take that into consideration. In terms of what analysts are anticipating out of the company at this point, well, you know, you run through the numbers as we've compiled from analyst estimates, and they're expecting, you know, a third straight quarter of lower earnings. But the real question is what happens in the fourth quarter and beyond, because at the same time, analysts are expecting profit to kind of be a little changed in the next quarter, or actually now the current quarter, and then to rebound next year. So, you know, we'll see how that all shakes out in terms of, you know, what the which would be the fiscal third quarter that Lennar would be reporting, how that all kind of stacks up here.
Sarah, I'd like to be, for the purposes of this segment, an impeachment-free zone, but before we were distracted by all of that, what are some of the other issues that are concerns for traders right now?
So there are a lot of risks that you could say are kind of hanging over this market or hovering over this market. For one, and we've been talking about it for, it seems almost like forever now, it's been a very long time, U.S.-China trade. One day it seems like things are going really well. The next day you see a turnaround, and it's pretty amazing that you still see at least headline risk filtering through to the market, moving up and down. Now, recent risks, uncertainties that we've also been discussing, observing within the markets, we're still seeing the repo market. It's very much calmed down, but you're dealing with the Fed interjection, the Fed operations at this point in time. Also, there's still a lot of risk and uncertainty in the Middle East when it comes to Iran. And certainly for the stock market, you haven't really seen that present a huge risk. But that's also because we haven't gotten any direction that there will be a protracted military event in the Middle East.
Bloomberg Stocks columnist Dave Wilson and Bloomberg Stocks reporter Sarah Poncik, thank you very much. And that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Daybreak Weekend. Join us again Monday morning at 5 Wall Street time for the latest on markets overseas and the news you need to start your day. I'm Bob Moon. This is Bloomberg.